morning. The next case on our docket is 20-30323, United States versus Hoffman. Mr. Hoffman.
Yes, Peter Hoffman, in pro per, may it please the court. I was given a custodial sentence of 20 months based on an intended loss amount of approximately $3.6 million. As Judge Dennis noted in his dissent on my first appeal, that intended loss amount is the basis for a custodial sentence. Otherwise, the guideline range would be 7 and probation an authorized sentence. I have, in fact, served a 5-year probation sentence. Despite imposing this custodial sentence, the district court concluded that it is, quote, now the law of the case that the state suffered no actual pecuniary loss. There was no victim and no loss. As Judge Dennis stated in his dissent in my original appeal, this is a, quote, no loss, victimless case. We delivered to the state an up-and-running production facility exactly what the state bargained for. The intended loss amount in issue was calculated in a PSR issued before the district court conducted a hearing on the state's claim for restitution of the tax credits granted to my company based on our first audit report. As the record shows, we withdrew our second audit report when the state objected to it. The district court in its order dismissed the state's claim for restitution because the state had failed to prove any loss. As the district court stated in the order under review, this portion of the PSR is stale and inaccurate. The state did not appeal that order, and hence it is res judicata that there was no victim and no loss in this case. As Judge Dennis stated in his dissent, the loss reflected in the PSR was a loss the state did not actually incur. And yet, the custodial sentence before you was based on that intended loss amount, which did not actually occur. When the state received our third audit report on completion of the project, the state itself, in September of 2012, long before the indictment, reinstated all credits released based on our first audit report with full knowledge of the investigation. And I mean reinstated as proper when granted in 2009, not issued based on the third audit report. The state certified another $3.6 million of base investment for which to this day we have never received tax credits on that amount. The stale and inaccurate PRC issued before my first sentencing and the two PSRs thereafter issued all assess no actual or intended loss amount based on the third audit report issued on completion of the project and when it was placed in service. The intended loss amount in issue thus arises solely from the first audit report, which was reinstated by the state, and the second audit report, which was withdrawn. As Judge Dennis stated in his dissent, the expenditures listed in the first and second audit report were not made all at the time the reports were issued, but we, quote, did ultimately make these expenditures, end quote. The district court stated that if he was not bound by the methodology of the first PSR, it would, quote, be persuaded regarding the government's failure to prove subjective intent concerning intended loss amount. The actual completion of the project negates any suggestion or finding that defendants purposely sought to inflict loss. The district court also acknowledged error in not making findings at my initial sentencing regarding the intended loss amount in the stale and inaccurate PSR, but nevertheless felt bound by the first PSR, which was rejected in the restitution order issue. The district court also included failure to make findings regarding the correct sentencing guidelines in a case of fraud in seeking government benefits, which is section 2B1.1 app note 3F2. That guideline is held in Nelson requires that the government prove that the government grant was diverted to some other non-approved purposes. No hey, such finding.
Mr. Hoffman, may I inquire, are you currently serving a sentence?
I just finished a 5-year probation, but I did not surrender for custody. The district court delayed my sentence until after this appeal and hopefully after the Brady motion that's now pending.
Okay. Would you, before you spend all of your time, would you please address first and foremost whether your notice of appeal was timely?
Sure. The issue is whether or not we were required to file a notice of appeal when the initial order was issued or whether that was stayed while we filed the motion for reconsideration. There are three Supreme Court decisions that have said that when you file a notice of reconsideration, the appeal period doesn't continue until that ends. This court so held in, I believe, the Greenfield case. But the important thing for us when we were looking at this question, because naturally we were concerned about it, was that there had been another case issued by this court, an unpublished opinion, which said that if we filed a notice of appeal while a motion for reconsideration was pending, that notice of appeal was defective. So we had a Hobson's choice. We either had to file, and stop the motion for reconsideration by filing the appeal, which would have been untimely because we had filed it, or follow Greenfield and the Supreme Court and wait until that appeal, that the reconsideration motion was determined. We feel the precedent in this court permits that, and in any event, we were faced with this Hobson choice where we could not just simply appeal and protect our right for the motion to reconsideration. They were inconsistent. So that's why we believe it's timely, and we believe this court's precedent is squarely to that effect.
Mr. Hoffman, I'd like to pose this question so both sides can address it thoroughly. The only thing they seem to really have against you is they say that you were found to have intended a $3.5 million loss to the state. I don't think this record shows that you or your other defendants intended to pocket $3.5 million. And I think, as everybody recognizes, the state did not lose anything. What you may be guilty of is you all were accelerating the time at which you realized, having earned the credits, maybe before they should have been. However, I saw nothing, or I know nothing about this case, and I'll ask Mr. Cameron to disabuse me if I'm wrong. I don't know of anything about this case that shows that y'all were going to make a big haul and personally become wealthy by taking $3.5 million. I think the record shows you completed what you were supposed to be under the tax incentive program. Maybe you didn't do everything you should have done on the way there, but none of that to me indicates an intent to permanently and ultimately cause the state of Louisiana loss of $3.5 million.
Yes, exactly. That's been our point throughout, and there was never an evidentiary hearing to address that very question. And as Judge Feldman said, the very fact that we completed the building and put it in service, and that was with a final cost report of $11.5 million. Even if we had gotten $3.6 million in credits, and we certainly didn't, we got $1.1 million, that's obviously way less than the amount that was actually spent on the building. And let me emphasize that the third PSR, every one of them, the first, second, and third PSR, has never said there was any actual or intended loss amount in connection with the third audit report once the project was completed. And there is, the court is indicating, a disconnect between the statute itself, which permits fraud. I think there was no fraud here, but assuming that's decided, then there's still the question under the guidelines of whether or not by the end of the day, we meant to go ahead and spend and deliver what we had promised the state we would deliver. And we think the facts are clear that we finished the building and put it in service. And that means there is no intended loss under the sentencing guidelines. What we tried to emphasize were a similar case where when you have a government contract and you make a false statement in obtaining the contract because of minority ownership, but nevertheless, you complete the building and do your work, and it's fine. The cases all say there's no intended loss amount. And that's particularly the case in government benefits, where there's a special sentencing guideline that says that you have to use it for unapproved purposes. So it's like you said.
But Mr. Hoffman, that brings us to the mandate rule again, does it not? In other words, exactly how was the district court's hands tied with respect to the arguments that you are now making?
I think it was because the mandate rule is comprised of two things, law of the case, and here there was no law of the case because no court has ever decided that there was an intended loss amount, as just described, or that there had been a hearing on whether or not we intended it. So there was never any evidentiary finding. And we didn't waive that argument, as what happened in the Montaleo case, because we actually, as the government acknowledged in our opposition brief, we raised both of those questions, both that the...
But isn't all that tied to the apparent holding of the court, the previous Court of Appeals on the guideline range? In other words, once they have decided the guideline range in the previous appeal, then these arguments that you are now making are precluded by the mandate rule. Am I correct or incorrect about that?
I believe you're incorrect, sir. And the reason is that the Court of Appeal did not make a finding on the guideline rules. It assumed that Judge Feldman had, and it assumed that even though there had never been an evidentiary hearing, there are no findings of fact, as Judge Feldman admitted his own error on that. And having none of that, the Court of Appeal simply assumed that there had been an assumption that the intended loss amount had been incurred. But even if that were all true, and even if the mandate rule applied, which we don't think it does, because there has never been any actual decision of an intended loss amount, there are two things. One, we did raise these issues in our brief. Second, we've made Brady arguments of evidence that goes to whether or not that should be put aside. And most important, the mandate rule is not a jurisdictional rule. It is not something that limits this court's ability to do anything. It can always be adjusted because of manifest injustice. And here you have the district court saying overtly, gee, if I had to deal with this now, I would agree there's no intended loss. It's hard to conceive of a more case of a manifest injustice should overcome whatever the mandate rule would apply, although we again say it doesn't apply because we didn't waive it, we raised the issues, we didn't have to waive it because we didn't raise the appeal, and no court, lower or above, despite our repeated objections to the intended loss amount, has ever made a ruling, including Judge Costa. He just assumed it was decided by Judge Feldman, and he even says that in a footnote.
Okay. Percent, go ahead.
I think I basically covered it. Just one more thing. There's a separate sentencing guideline that was also not taken into account, and that is that you can get credit for the value you gave, so as a set off against an intended loss amount. No one has ever reviewed that, and if you review that, it also would allow for a consideration of taking into account, which was not done, the actual completion and putting the building in service. But other than that, I'll reserve my time, the balance of my time, unless there's any other questions from the court.
Mr. Kammer?
Sorry, I had to unmute myself. Good morning, Your Honors. Dal Kammer for the United States. I'd like to start by answering each of Your Honors had a specific question. And Judge Owen, I'd like to start first with yours about the timeliness of the appeal in Rule 4. Since the Greenwood case was ruled, the Rule of Appellate Procedure 4 was amended in 2002 to deal with this particular situation, which is that Rule 35 does not suspend the time for the filing of a notice of appeal. And the advisory committee notes on that amendment, it actually mentions this court's ruling in the Carmouche case and Carmouche's case, that the Carmouche case talked about the First Circuit's case in Murillo to try to bring some clarity to that. So under federal rules of appellate procedure as they exist now, that is, this appeal is untimely. It was not filed until 14 days after, and it says that a Rule 35 motion does not suspend the time for filing a motion.
Is this a Rule 35 motion?
Well, Judge, he does, in the original motions, he didn't specify Rule 35. He used common law motions like Rule 51.
I mean, does Greenwood still apply to a motion that's denominated as a common law motion?
It doesn't, Your Honor. And this court held in Dorsey that Rule 60 motions, the civil law motions that Mr. Hoffman tried to use, don't apply in the criminal law context. But
still, we have not specifically overruled Greenwood.
You have not, Your Honor. That is correct. You have not. What I'm suggesting is now that we have a change in the rules since Greenwood, that is something that the court should take into consideration, as you have done in past cases when rules were changed.
But you acknowledge there's a distinction between the rule and Greenwood. Greenwood,
yes, Your Honor.
The general on the common law right of appeal, and Rule 35 is the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure. So still, we have not overruled Greenwood.
That is true, Your Honor.
Technically, the rules themselves, or the amendment to the rule, does not affect Greenwood to the extent that it is based on a common law rule or appeal.
I would agree, Your Honor, to the extent it deals with a motion that's not specific to a final judgment of sentencing, which this court held in Bridges is a final judgment. And it's set differently than other motions, other common law motions. Like under the Healy Doctrine, other motions in a criminal case could toll the time for filing that law still is fine, just as long as it's not dealing with a motion on a final sentence. Rule 3582 is very specific that it is a final sentence at that point. And I believe that this court has said, particularly in the Hankton case, that district court can only do anything as long as it's a uncontroversial technical error within 14 days. But the new amended Rule 4, 2002 amendment says that does not interrupt the 14 days to file the appeal. But yes, Judge Jolly, I do agree that other motions that don't file into the sentencing world or dealing with the final judgment of sentencing would still apply under the Healy Doctrine. It could interrupt the appellate period. Judge Dennis, I'd like to respond to your question about the loss figures in this case. I think it's undisputed in this case that the building that ended up at 807 Esplanade was a $5 million home. Mr. Hoffman and his co-defendants submitted $13 million in expenses for that $5 million home. During the trial, the government put on evidence that from the very get-go, Mr. Hoffman intended, in some of his board minutes that we put in there, to pay for the entire cost of that building through no cash cost to the company through Louisiana tax credits. And it was during, I forget the record site for it, but it was during the very end of Mr. Hoffman's cross-examination that the government brought that to the jury's attention. So you are correct in the fact that there is a building that was built there, but the concern here is the extravagant, unsupported, false expenditures that were submitted in order to pay for that fully through tax credits. And I'd like to point out something also to Your Honor, that when the district court ruled on this in the resentencing, it made a specific finding that Mr. Hoffman deserved the 20 years or that a time of imprisonment would have been reasonable. And it made a specific finding because of his leadership position and his perseverance in the scheme. And that's consistent with what the district court said during the first sentencing. During the first sentencing, the court stated, and this would be at the record at page 11177, the transcript of Mr. Hoffman's first sentencing, that Mr. Hoffman's conduct is indeed somewhat troubling. The issue of the legal fees, the Conway fee, and the Conway fee was a false payment to a consultant that the consultant flew from the United Kingdom and testified that he never received. His relationship with the contractor, Leo Duvernay. So Judge Feldman did find during the first sentencing and then made specific findings in the second sentencing that support that he feels that Mr. Hoffman went above and beyond. And I think that your concerns, Judge Dennis, with the actual loss or the victim, what the victim lost in this case, clearly Judge, the district court considered that in downward departing 148 months. He took that into consideration along with this court's mandate and made his own individual finding that Mr. Hoffman's leadership role and his perseverance in the scheme made a 20-month sentence substantively reasonable. Judge Jolly, with regard to the mandate rule, I'd like to address that briefly. This court does take a very limited role, a very limited scope of mandate in a criminal context. The court has recognized that the district court is not to do anything other than what this court mandates that it do. This court considered the guidelines. It was front and center of the of that entire lengthy opinion that was written. Mr. Hoffman briefed in his reply brief most of the objections to the sentencing that he did the first time that was before this court. So all the issues regarding sentencing and the sentencing guidelines were front and center before this court. And the court does take a limited mandate. The court recognized that Mr. Hoffman's, in its opinion, recognized that Mr. Hoffman's guidelines would not change because of the counts that this court instituted. And that was in contrast with what it said about the other defendant that was resentenced. It recognized that his guidelines would have to be recalculated because the sentence, the counts of conviction that were reinstituted against him would require the guidelines would go up. But it specifically said Mr. Hoffman's guidelines wouldn't change because of those. And it mandated it for resentencing because probation was a step too far and sent it down. And then on remand, with such a substantial downward variance by the district court, clearly the district court took into consideration its concerns that Judge Dennis brings up and gave a vast downward departure.
Well, the present sentence is 20 months, is that it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What is the present sentence that Judge Feldman imposed on remand?
On remand, 20 months, Judge, and the guidelines were 168 to 210 right, now, months.
Are you, refresh me on this, are you seeking any kind of, are you appealing the sentence in any way?
No, Your Honor, the government has not filed an appeal in this matter.
Okay. So you're only the defendant, just plainly a defendant in this?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, good, thank you.
Yes, sir, thank you. With regard, I'd like to address a couple of issues. Also, Judge Dennis, an issue that came up when it comes to intended loss. If you'll notice in the pre-sentence investigation from this resentencing at paragraph 62, there is a very lengthy, well, not lengthy, it's a full-page spreadsheet of the intended loss amounts, the fraudulent expenses that the government proved at trial. Listed in there are sections of, or in parentheses, are sections where the PSR gives the defendants credit for money that we could actually show that they expended. For instance, in the first audit report, it gives them credit for the actual purchase price of the building. It gives them credit for the money we could show that the contractor actually received. So that was taken into consideration in where the guidelines ended up, that he was given credit for money that we could actually show that the people had expended. But the people that took the stand and said they never received a dollar, that would fall into intended loss. That was a purely fraudulent claim for an expenditure. I'd like to, this kind of goes hand in hand with Rule 4 to some extent, but the district court correctly dismissed Mr. Hoffman's motion under Rule 35. Now, the judge analyzed it under 3582, but that is the only thing that we can see out of 3582 that would apply here is a Rule 35 motion. Now, Judge Feldman dismissed it approximately 86 days after the final sentencing happened, and he did it on the merits. And that he did it according to this court's holdings in cases like Hankton, where it has to be an uncontroversial error, a technical arithmetic error that can be changed under that. So that's where the judge ended up properly dismissing Mr. Hoffman's motion for reconsideration. However, there's another reason. The ruling was past 14 days, and this court's case law is very clear that after 14 days, there can be no correction to that sentence. So for two reasons, on the merits and because of the time period. The case that Mr. Hoffman cited to your honors in his reply brief, the Berry case, it's a 2017 Fifth Circuit case that I believe he was referring to in his oral argument. That's a more recent case. It does talk about Greenwood in that case, but it's a different situation than what we have here. The Berry case dealt with a motion from the defendant under 3582C because there had been a change in the guidelines, the drug guidelines that applied to him. And that's an authorized motion under Rule 3582C. The defendant then filed a motion or filed his notice of appeal, and when this court reviewed it, realized that the court below hadn't ruled on it yet. There's no time limit on a 3582C motion when there's been a change in the guidelines. It's completely, so it recognized, Judge Jolly, what you were saying is that by citing to Greenwood, that there are some situations where Greenwood says it will toll the period that you have to file your notice of appeal. But that's just not the case when it's a motion for reconsideration of a final sentence, as it is in this case. So the Berry case is not on point with where we are now. The last two issues that Mr. Hoffman brings up in his appeal is first of all, the discretion for the evidentiary hearings before this court. And just briefly to walk you through everything that went on prior to this, Mr. Hoffman, during the first sentence, was given an opportunity. The briefing in this case has been extraordinarily long. We briefed the issues before the first sentence. He was given a chance to object to the PSR. We then came on appeal. The government noticed its appeal during the first sentencing. The government challenged the substantive reasonableness of the case, of the sentence, of the probation sentence, in part based on the high guidelines. Mr. Hoffman was aware of that. We brought the case. We noticed a sentence of his appeal. Noticed an appeal of his sentence to this court. He was aware of that. We then, our main arguments and what this court considered were the sentencing guidelines. He replied to those. Then we got to the second resentencing. The judge ordered lots of briefing for that. The point being, Your Honors, is that Mr. Hoffman received tremendous due process in bringing his objections before the court, and the court correctly ruled when it did. It didn't need to give an evidentiary hearing. It sat through all this briefing on the facts and the issues of this case. It sat through a two-week trial. It sat through 500 exhibits that were presented during this trial. And what's interesting is that although Mr. Hoffman asked for an evidentiary hearing before the second resentencing, he didn't ask for an evidentiary hearing before the first sentencing. That wasn't when we went into this. Well, partially because we had just come through a lengthy trial and briefed it. But that's when we get to the second resentencing, and the judge was he did not abuse his discretion in not wanting to hear a rehash of everything that he had been briefed and witnessed by himself. Your Honors, unless anybody has any other questions for me, I'd like to briefly conclude. The mandate in this case was very limited, and it was limited for Mr. Hoffman to be resentenced to a term above probation. And the district court correctly followed that mandate. The U.S. District Court correctly dismissed this under Rule 35, although dismissed the motion under Rule 35, although should have been dismissed because it was untimely. And finally, this under the new 2002 amendments, this court, the Rule 4 makes this untimely because it wasn't filed until after 14 days. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Hoffman?
Yes, just to correct a few things. The final audit report showed, 11,500,000 of expenditures on this building. The PSR itself does not suggest that any of those amounts were intended loss. These were exactly the amounts that were used to obtain federal historic rehabilitation credits, which were fully allowed and never challenged. So when he says there's only a quote $5 million building, end quote, that statement is not supported by the record. It assumes that the value of the real estate and all the costs associated with converting it to a post-production somehow don't count, including the interest that were properly charged to it. So the statement that there's only $5 million and everything over that was somehow fraudulent is fully unsupported by the record. Again, the government continues to make statements that there were false statements about what was paid. The final audit report puts that to rest, as Judge Dennis recognized in his defense. Everything in the final audit report was paid. A specific reference to Conway, as we said in our brief, we never claimed we paid Mr. Conway. We claimed we paid somebody else who was then responsible for that payment, as was fully disclosed and was retracted in the third audit report. So This was an $11.5 million building, but in any event, it doesn't matter because the state itself reinstated $6.5 million. So Mr. Kammer asked you to believe that the state itself was wrong, that there was a $6.5 million certified investment in this case. Now, second, there has never been a hearing, despite repeated requests, including at the first pre-sentence report, on whether or not the government met its burden as required by the cases to establish not the fraud at trial, but the proof of an intended loss amount in any perjury. That never happened. The fact that it was also irrelevant because the judge did not make his decision based on the briefing. He said he was bound by the mandate rule. So therefore, all of our briefing and all of the things we said were irrelevant. So that you can't walk around an evidentiary hearing, you have to then address the mandate rule, and that falls because no one has ever considered it. I have never had a chance to force the government to its proof on the intended loss amount that there was an intention to cause a loss. And as Judge Feldman said, and he clearly believed based on the evidence, there was no intended loss amount. Briefly on the issue of attempt to overrule Greenfield. Prosecutors are making a careful and, in my opinion, unsustainable distinction of Barry. Barry was a case where a notice of appeal was considered untimely when a motion for reconsideration was pending. The government seems to suggest, because that motion for reconsideration, in their opinion, was well-founded, that therefore it shouldn't apply in my case, where it assumes saying that my motion for reconsideration was also without merit. Among the merits in mine was the simple error that Judge Feldman had made, sending me to yet two more years of probation when that violated the five-year probation rule, to say nothing of the new facts from the coronavirus infections. So my motion for reconsideration was based on those limited grounds permitted by a common law motion for reconsideration. It was not saying, oh, gee, Your Honor, we think you misapprehended the various enhancements or other aspects of the sentence, so please rethink your sentence. That's what we were asking to do, even if there was such a limited exception. This was a common law motion for reconsideration. And as I said in the brief, there is really no way to try to manage down that to some cases where it's only for the sentence. Even in the case in the Seventh Circuit, if you throw out a case and give it a new trial, it's obviously going to affect the sentence. Let me see if there's anything else. All of this goes to the question of whether or not the proving that we put the building in service at a $11.5 million cost that is not disputed even by the government in the PSR establishes there was no intended loss amount. Your Honors, there was no intended loss amount because we did what we told the government we would do. We completed the building, as Judge Feldman has recognized and as indeed the state itself recognized. And I believe that ends my time. Thank you, Your Honor, for your attention.
Thank you. Your case is under submission.
Thank you.